danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 202 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Las Vegas, Nevada. I am Andrew Brokus. I will be joined shortly by Nate Mavis and also by Christian Harder. I imagine Christian Harder needs no introduction, but for those of you who don't know, Christian Harder has been a long-time winning tournament and cash game player, but we know him, Nate and I know him, actually from way back on the 2+2 tournament forums. He's just consistently a big winner online, has been a big winner live, most recently just won the main event of the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure. So lots to talk to Christian about, and just an all-around nice guy. Fun conversation, and we will have that coming up in just a moment. As I mentioned, I am in Las Vegas at the moment, have been traveling a fair bit this week, so didn't find a time to record a proper introduction with Nate, which means we're not going to have a full strategy segment, and we'll get into the interview with Christian in just a moment. If you are looking for strategy, specifically tournament poker strategy, Tournament Poker Edge is the place to go for that. Tournament Poker Edge features content targeted for a wide variety of skill levels, tournament formats, and learning styles, so you're sure to find videos that are right for you, including videos produced by Nate and myself if you are hankering for some tournament strategy from us specifically. Start your free trial today at tournamentpokeredge.com. As I mentioned, there are videos from Nate and myself at Tournament Poker Edge, but for even more coaching from us, and specifically for cash game coaching from us, come check out our event in the New York City area, March 25th and 26th. You will get to meet, greet, and eat with us, as well as the guys from the Just Hands Poker podcast. Plus, you will play a four-hour deep-stacked cash game session and have your play reviewed by the four of us. For more information and full details on this event, check out justhandspoker.com/thinkingpokernyc. Or if that's too much for you to write down and remember and type in, you can just look for the link in the show notes. Okay, here comes the interview with Christian Harder. Enjoy. Yeah, well, thanks for agreeing to do this, Christian. I'm glad we could finally work it out.
Sorry, I could. Took me a while, but I finally got here.
No, that's I think it's my own anxiety more than anything. It's just hard to tell with poker players as a group, and you're far from the only person this has happened with. It's hard to tell whether people are just like, flaky or difficult to schedule with or whatever, or if it's like they don't actually want to do the show, and I'm kind of reluctant to like keep pushing. Just like if people don't get back to me after once or twice, I'm like, he probably hates us, so I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah, it was more just me. I don't know.
No, I figured that was probably the case.
I'm not that flaky usually, but thank you for messaging me today, because I actually, obviously, because I'm an idiot, I forgot, but I was free. So.
Great. So I sometimes, if it's somebody who I don't know very well who's going to be on the show, we'll try to do like a little bit of research on them or something, and I was like, oh, Christian, I know Christian, and then like as we were about to start the show, I was like, I don't think I really know Christian that well. Are you from Annapolis? Is that where you were born?
I'm from, and I still live there. Yeah.
Okay, and for people who don't know, Annapolis is the capital of Maryland, most famous, I guess, for having the U.S. Naval Academy there. I mean, how else would you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the capital on the water, the Naval Academy. Pretty much those things are pretty typical. I love it. I mean, it's where I've been, my whole life, so I call it home, and I still do, and I've thought about moving many of times over the past years, Vegas, New Jersey, Florida, California, and I can never pull the trigger. I mean, a little bit is just, it's just what I just enjoy living here. I don't know.
You've got to be the only professional poker player based out of Annapolis.
Oh, I'm sure there's someone who you know, grinds 2-5 Maryland Live or something. But pretty much, I think, professional probably, yeah.
What do you like about it so much? What's keeping you there?
I still have family here. That's a big thing, obviously. You know, a few friends. I enjoy the fact that it's still like a little bit of a city downtown, but it's not too big of a city. It's like a good size, I feel like.
Yeah, it's very charming. Charming would be high on the list of adjectives I would use to describe it.
It is charming. The downtown Annapolis is like, you know, one of my favorite places to go for sure.
Are you saying that Charm City is not the most charming city in Maryland?
I did.
It is far from the most charming city in Maryland.
I did live in Baltimore for 1 year, which I enjoyed, but I just, you know, you always come home. At least I do.
Yeah, that's exactly what I say about Baltimore. It's like, oh, I lived there 1 year. Yeah, it's great. Love it. Nah, don't live there anymore.
That's all right.
What did the poker journey look like for you? When did you start playing poker?
So I started playing in high school, like a lot of people my age. I'm 29, sort of moneymaker-esque. I had a friend. I had a kid that we weren't even really friends with that was in like a different grade than us. So he would like go to one of our lunches. I was a junior. He was a sophomore. And I remember so he didn't like know anyone really in our grade, but he would sit with us for one every 4 days. And at one point I think we invited him to sit at a table because I think he was literally sitting by himself. And he's actually one of my best friends to this day, Joel Bidnick. And he was already into poker. And me and a couple other friends, we really, you know, we didn't really know anything about it, but we were very interested about it. And basically starting, you know, as soon as we became friends with him, we went over to his house. And since then, you know, and then we started playing online. Then we were playing home games. Yeah. And that's really where it all started. I then went to school for 2.5 years, a couple colleges.
You went to Maryland?
I actually didn't go to Maryland. I'm a diehard Maryland fan, but I didn't go to Maryland.
I see you wearing Maryland gear.
I know. I'm a big Maryland fan. But I went to George Mason in Northern Virginia to major in politics. I had this, you know, fantasy about what I was going to be. You know what I mean?
Wait, sorry. Are you like a libertarian type? Because that's what George Mason is best known for, at least to me, politically.
No, I think I'm a little more on the left libertarian. I mean, in terms of, you know, fiscal issues. But... yeah, I had some idea that I'd be a lawyer, and then I just realized I just started playing poker the whole time. And then I transferred because I was basically playing poker the whole time and not really caring about school. And then I transferred again, and then I dropped out to play poker.
Turns out that going from one school to another is not the most, like when your problem is that you're just playing poker all the time. It's
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, I need to change of scenery. No, I'm still playing poker. So basically, 2.5 years... in, it's winter break 2008, and I get seventh in the PCA for 200,000, and it's winter break because it's early January when the PCA is, and then I just drop out and don't go back to the next semester. And since then, I've been playing poker. Yeah, long time.
Any regrets related to that?
No. Sometimes I wonder, you know, what my trajectory would have been. You know, I always wonder about things like that. I'm a curious person, but I no regrets.
Yes, I did maybe a little bit of the same thing, where I kind of like had the idea that I might go to law school, and a friend who got into college or got into poker about the same time that I did, sort of my best friend through college, and he ended up, you know, going to law school when I took the poker trajectory, and he's in a pretty good place now. But for a couple of years, he was a corporate lawyer and was really miserable, and it was interesting. I could kind of see like a, you know, this is you in an alternate universe sort of thing, and I was at the time I was feeling kind of smug, but he's got sort of a nice setup now.
Yeah, I will also say, like, I wasn't the greatest student, and I wasn't the greatest test taker, so my route, it was a little easier for me, I feel like, because it's not like I'm, like, turning down, like, you know, Ivy Leagues and all this type of stuff. I feel like I had an easier decision. I was probably better, at poker than I was a student, obviously, but, you know, like, my whole life, I had ideas of what I wanted to do, but basically, it just came down to I just loved poker, and I was doing well with it, and it just really didn't make sense for me to go to school anymore at the time. For example, my last semester at college, I took 4 classes. I dropped 3 of them, all except public speaking, which I got a C in. That's my only credit from Salisbury University in Maryland. So I mean that tells a lot. Like I'm not the best student, and I was doing well in poker, very well back then. So it was just easy decision. So no regrets overall, for sure.
Yeah, if you had told me you transferred to Salisbury, I definitely would have predicted that you weren't going to finish. No, nobody transfers to Salisbury so they can take school more seriously.
Exactly. I kept getting worse and worse in my colleges, which is also a tell that it's probably not going to work well for you.
I mean, was being a professional poker player already kind of on your radar? I mean, I remember you from 2+2 around that era. So, I mean, I guess you were already connected to other people who were, like, dropping out of college to play poker.
For sure. 2007, I started doing really well online. And I remember actually posting a thread about if I should drop out of school, which Stealth Monk just lit me up. It's pretty great. I actually haven't read it. I haven't read this thread in, like, 2 years, but I'd have to, like, go back and read it again.
But lit you up, like, told you you're terrible?
You're an idiot. Like, you know, you won one tournament. Like, I think it was like a week after I won the Full Tilt 1K in 2007 for like 80,000. And yeah, he's like, you're just a lucky idiot. Yeah, you're an idiot. Like, what do you, like, you won one tournament, you're ready to drop out of school. I don't know. So that was pretty funny. So yeah, it was for sure on my radar. And then PCA just sort of like, all right, I have money. I actually have like real money now. So yeah, makes sense.
I mean, at the time that you could play online, were you doing that? I mean, I guess there weren't casinos in Maryland at the time, so I guess you were pretty much exclusively an online player, except for, you know, what, PCA and WSOP?
Yeah, I wasn't even 21 until 2009. So yeah, I was exclusively online, and I played basically the EPT season in 2009. I went like everywhere, or 2008, because I wasn't 21. And then I started playing more and more live, and I started doing really well live. And then around 2010, I would probably say I was mostly a live player, though I still played a lot online in 2010. And
was, then even before Black Friday, you were like getting to be mostly live?
I mean, not like drastically, maybe like 60% live. It's hard to say a percent, you know. Mm-hmm. How do you even quantify that besides time, I guess? But probably, yeah, 2010 I was playing maybe 60% live. And then 2011, I all of a sudden decided I wanted to be, I started playing more PLO, and all of a sudden I was like, I'm going to get Supernova Elite. So I never was close to Supernova Elite on PokerStars for my entire existence until 2011, when I had like 400,000 VPPs, which was like on pace to get Supernova Elite on Black Friday, playing PLO actually, mostly. So that was funny. And then obviously that just, you know, didn't go well, but Black Friday, of course. But yeah, since then, obviously, I've played mostly live and looked out.
How'd you get into PLO?
I don't even remember. Probably sometime in 2009 or like early 2010, I started dabbling in it and maybe watching some videos or something along the lines. And then 2010, at the end of 2010, I started getting like pretty serious at it and doing decently. And back then, if you could win pre-rake back, like, you could just make so much money off getting Supernova Elite. So I was like, all right, I'll just take a couple hundred thousand, you know, from rake back, and two PTBB per hundred or whatever, plus rake back's a lot of money back then.
And who were your people at that time? I mean, I kind of think of you now as being, you know, pretty friendly with like Greg Merson and that crew. I mean, did you kind of like come up with them, or did you just get to know them later through playing live poker in the region?
I think a lot of like pre like 2009, 2008, there's a lot of like the high school guys, like my friend Joel. And then around maybe 2008 or 2009, I became closer with Tony Gregg and Greg Merson. Mm-hmm. And I actually briefly for a year lived with both of them in Tony's house in Columbia, Maryland. Isn't that where, I think that's you, where you're from, right, Andrew, or no?
I'm from Catonsville, but pretty close to Columbia. Yeah.
Close enough. So around then, 2009, I became good friends with both of them. I've been friends with them since Turning Stone days, maybe 2007. And since then, yeah, I'm great friends with them. But yeah, I have a ton of friends because, you know, I've been in poker for so long that, I've been in the live circle and the online circle. So you just meet so many people, and that's where a majority of my friends are now in the poker world, for sure.
And you were friends with Greg, I guess, while he was, I don't know a whole lot about his story, but I mean, I know what he talked about on the podcast that Shane Schlager did about drugs.
Oh, yeah.
Dope Stories, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so you were friends with him, I guess, when he was kind of going through the worst of his drug stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I remember was at Five Diamond in 2000. I don't even remember the year. I want to say 2010, but it might have been 2011. Where he was struggling, and I was staying with him. Me, Tony, and Greg were staying together, and so he just during that trip in Vegas, he sort of had a realization. We were just sort of like, you know, me and Tony said some things to him, and all of a sudden he called his mom crying, and since then he's been clean, which, you know, it's awesome, because to see how well he did, you know, the following World Series, I'm getting my years mixed up, but to see him, you know, do so well, I mean, he deserves it. He's an amazing player, an amazing grinder, and I love the kid for sure.
And you were there on the rail, right, when he won?
Yeah, I was there. I was there for sure. It was a ton of fun. Definitely the most fun I ever had, you know, in not playing poker, but involved in a poker tournament somewhere.
What do you see as your role in that, like when you're, you know, railing somebody at the WSOP final table? I mean, were you involved in like helping him prepare for the final table? Like, I mean, I guess not exactly coaching, but, you know.
Yeah. You know, Greg didn't really prepare that much. I mean, I think back then people really didn't even like, I think, was it the second year of the November 9? Again, my years are mixed up. But
it was early.
You know, Greg did some stuff with Tony, but he didn't really do much. And we were always there to help him, but he wasn't studying like PO Solver, not that even existed back then, but so he didn't do much. I mean, Greg is such like a, you know, he was an online player, but at the same time he's like a field player. And it's kind of hard to teach like talented guys like that like things that are exactly math based, besides like maybe shove charts anyone can learn, but you know, the intricacies of playing like 50 big blind stacks, it's kind of hard to like, it's hard to teach that, you know what I mean? Yeah. Well, and Greg's such an amazing like, has amazing instincts and amazing field player that we, you know, he didn't want to like try to touch that, which obviously worked out. I mean, he played an amazing final table and worked out for him.
So when you say it can be hard to teach a field player math stuff, one thing some people sometimes mean is that like their skills aren't suited to it, either like they're not interested in learning the math or they might be susceptible to making some mistakes if they try to apply it in game. Another thing people might mean is that their whole game is built around some things. And like me as a live player, I do this stuff all the time where, you know, I might just call a raise with a hand I should 3-bet because it sets up a certain situation that I know how to play really well against a certain kind of player. And there are all these sort of like, there's this whole like entangled web of strategic things that I'm doing in part because like I'm a live guy. And it sounds like, is that like more what Greg's situation was?
I mean, there's just so many like nuisance things that are even hard to like put into words that like Greg does, or even Tony. I mean, or even me, like even though we were all like online players and all of us very successful online, we weren't exactly like the most like math people. Like we knew the math, but we didn't, you know, we kind of just knew it instinctively. We wouldn't study the math, you know, because over time when you play so many hands, when you like, I was reading the forms, you know, 2+2 my whole life, or you know, since I was 17 16, and just like picking up things. And that's, you know, because I'm not a great like test taker in math. Like I'm sure like Most players who've had a ton of success would all do better at a math test than me. And it's just like something where it's something in your, I don't know, I don't even know how to explain it, where I have something in my brain where I can like somehow analyze poker without actually, you know, in the math behind it without actually knowing it, which especially in PLO, which I was playing a lot of, and I still play a lot of, it's even worse not to know the math. I mean, I've tried, and you know, I got PLO coaching at one point, which is a very math-based PLO coaching, and I really struggled to kind of comprehend like a lot of these things, especially when I like take it to a lot of live arena. So yeah, I think especially Greg and Tony, they're just blessed with amazing instincts, and with an online, the fact that they played online first, you know, it kind of like makes up for some of it. I feel like, I don't really know how to explain that, but do you know what I mean? Like, even though they're not like the sickest math, amazing at math, you know, the fact that they played online and succeeded online, you just kind of learn it instinctively over time because you're doing a lot of short stack play. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I think a great illustration of all this is your recent final table at the PCA. Congratulations, by the way. For listeners who don't know, Charter won the main event at PCA, so good job, Christian. Yeah. But three-handed to your direct right, and somebody who was on your right for most of that final table was, you know, certainly an experienced poker player, but somebody who you might characterize as a little bit more of an amateur. Like, I mean, he isn't. He has another job. He's a fun player. And boy, you made a lot of really, like, watching that final table cards up, you just made right choice after right choice, and you were obviously also keeping him comfortable, like, not overly gregarious, but perfectly polite and friendly, and he's more of a guy who likes to do the talking himself, so I think he liked that. And it's you can just see you making, like, really good choice after really good choice, including some sort of counterintuitive preflop folds that I think, like, 93% of online sickos would not make in your spot. So so nice job. Would you say that my characterization of that is correct?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was really lucky, blessed at that final table, to have a stack situation where really I could put a ton of pressure on, because I was, after I knocked out the first guy, there's five left, and I have the chip lead. And then pretty much, and then there's the guy who's kid in second, who's very ICM aware. Mm-hmm. And then there's three people who have about the same stack. And it really, because the kid in second is not going to try to, like, play a big pot with me, like, I know that, it really just gives me an amazing situation where I can look better than I should. You know what I mean? By getting to raise a lot of hands. And yeah, I mean, I ran well in knowing when to pick on Mike. I mean, you could say ran well, but, you know, there's just certain spots where you know you can apply pressure, and you know that he's not gonna play back without a monster. And, like, luckily, you know, it really was just kind of a dream final table, and that I never really had any big confrontations pre-flop or even post-flop because of, you know, picking up a lot of chips without showdown because of the stack situation.
Well, I mean, you mentioned, you know, not really approaching the game in a explicitly mathematical way. I mean, what was your process for learning and getting better?
For me, it was just playing a lot. I started out not a very good player, and a lot of it was reading 2+2, actually, more so than playing. Is learning how people, because, you know, in the pre-Black Friday days, good players gave away information on 2+2, which is a shock now. You never see anything like that anymore, but. You could find out tons of information and how people think.
Yeah.
Just trying to think the right way, I feel like, is just such a huge thing. And it's harder. It gets harder and harder. There's not much information people give away unless you want to pay $99 a month to run it once, which I do, by the way. But whatever. Just figuring out why people think about spots and playing thousands of hands. And so it's something that I eventually it clicked. Growing up, I was a very competitive person, and I love sports, and I still do. But I wasn't very good at them. And then I had this thing where I was in mock trial, and I was pretty good at that. And then I thought I was going to be a lawyer as I went over. but then I realized, you know, then I found poker, and I was like, well, this is sort of like sports, and it's sort of like, you know, using your brain. And it's something I just, like, became obsessed with over time. So I put so much effort. Like, my friend Joel, who I mentioned before many times on this, growing up with him, he was, like, always, like, better than me in high school as a poker player, and even, like, early college. But he went to college and actually, like, went to school and did classes and graduated. And I skipped classes and, like, became enamored of poker. And that, for me, it was just time. It was just effort. It was just reading 2+2 every day, reading all the good players' posts, playing every day, talking to people. And I think that, opposed to me, like, learning over time, like, learning, you know, the math and just, like, becoming better overnight or whatever, that would really help me. And it's also the fact that back then, it's not like math, it's not like all these programs are readily available anyways. 2009, no one had any of these things. They might have had a shove chart, that's about it, right? Mm-hmm. So it helped me, you know, I got it at the right time, you know, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't need, like, there was time for you to learn math by feel. Like, you didn't have to just, it's not like everyone else was doing it perfectly.
No, and if you watched, I'm sure it would be amazing to watch, like, even a 1K, like a final table in 2008, to see how people played. I mean, it would probably be laughable. But, you know, that's why poker, it's evolved, and it's a really tough game, and, yeah.
How different do you think the game will look in 5 years from today? Like, do you think it'll look laughable, or do you think it'll just look a little more advanced?
Well, I think online poker will be extremely advanced and almost dead.
Yeah.
Especially rest of the world, you know, where you can play on everyone, play with everyone, opposed to like niche states or whatever, like we have now in the US. I think that would be extremely advanced, and it will almost just not be worth it to play online. Yeah. I think live poker will always be good. I think recreational players love live poker. And it's a great hobby, even, and, you know, it's thriving. I think live poker is still thriving. So I think in 5 years, live poker will look similar, actually.
Yeah.
Where an online will be extremely hard. That's what.
So, I mean, I agree that online poker will be extremely hard. But, like, if you look back, like, I mean, you said that a final table, even a 1K final table from 5 years ago would look... I mean, it would look crazy. I mean, I think we would actually laugh out loud. I mean, like, the bet sizing would look... crazy. I mean, we'd all see a million things. Everybody would fold their big blind for one more big blind, even when it would look nuts. Like, we would say that these are, you know, just complete fish by today's standards. I guess, do you think that there's anything about today's game that will look that crazy in 5 years?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Like, do you think people will be laughing out loud, or it'll just be like a little bit tougher? I mean, it'll be a lot tougher, but in all these imperceptible ways.
I mean, this is just this read could be off, but I do think over time it will go back to people defending a little bit tighter than they are now.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like last year or the last 2 years were sort of like the peak of call 100% in the big blind versus 2.5x, regardless if you're heads up, regardless, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, I've talked to Tony and Greg about this a lot of times. Where if you're playing against a good player and you're deep, it's just you're often just burning money.
Yeah,
calling. I mean, I still call very loose out of the big blind, you know, more, any obviously looser than I did 3 years ago. But I think over time that actually might go back to being a little tighter. As far as like a big thing or a general thing, I'm not sure I can even like, it's hard for me to predict that though. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a very small thing, obviously.
Yeah, it's a small thing, but it's a small thing that makes the game look like much, much different, because it's not just raise and take it for 5 hours. So that's, I've heard that at the super high rollers, players are starting to adjust by opening a little bit larger. Is that true? And B, do you think that's going to stick?
I definitely think that's true. I just played the WPT in Borgata. I was playing with Byron Caverman, who I played with on multiple occasions. And I noticed this in Texas to Tony and Greg. He was 3xing from all positions,
mm-hmm.
which I hadn't seen. I played with him before, and I'm positive he didn't do that before. And you don't really see that from high stakes, from like the, you know, the high roller circuit guys. So that was interesting to me. I think, but yeah, because of people defending too much and charging them more, for sure.
What I mean, did you have a sense when you started playing poker professionally? I mean, did you have an idea of like, this is going to be my job forever, or was it just sort of like, well, you know, school's not going that great anyway, and I'm making a lot of money doing this now, so I'm just going to like do this for a while and see what happens?
Yeah, I don't think I had a plan. I think ideally in my head I was like, all right, 10 years, 5 years, and then I'll do something else. But at the same time, I didn't have. It was not, you know, near concrete at all. And still to this day, I'm like, I don't know. Am I going to be playing in 3 years? Am I going to be playing professionally in 7 years? Probably not. But I don't really know. And I don't really know what's next. So it's hard. You know, I've dabbled in some things, you know, like investing in random companies, but nothing that could actually stop playing poker and get a job tomorrow. And I am a college dropout, as I mentioned. So once again, that if I want to get a real job besides, you know, being the boss, I'd probably have to graduate. You know? So hopefully
I'll say you
open my own business and I don't have to graduate college or something like that.
Is that something you've given serious thought to?
I wouldn't say serious thought, because I don't even know what it'd be. So
definitely, that was my next question.
We'll see. I think I'll be playing professionally in 5 years, but I don't think I will in 10 years, if I had to guess.
How do you feel like it's worked out for you in the time since? I mean, obviously you've had a lot of success. I mean, did you have expectations? Have you exceeded your expectations? Did you think at the time that you started you'd still be doing it now?
I don't think I really had expectations. I think overall, I've been very lucky. There are definitely some times where I was questioning whether I was, still beating these high stakes tournaments. Because for a while, up until PCA, I had a year in 2016 was flat out like awful in tournaments. I've been lucky that I've played cash, for the better part of 4 years. Not full time, but enough that, it can help you in tournament downswings. Which, if you don't play cash and you just play tournaments, it's pretty brutal. Which some people do, and man, that's rough.
Yeah.
But overall, I'm happy with where I've gone, where I've been, and my results, for sure. Yeah.
Do you? It sounds like you still think of yourself as kind of fundamentally a tournament player, and you just like cash helps to smooth out the variance.
Yeah, it's I've gone in spurts over the past couple of years where I was just like, all right, I'm gonna play less and less tournaments, but I still sort of have that bug for sure. But I really do enjoy cash, and I've done pretty well at it for the most part. So, and it's just a smarter thing to do. It's a smarter thing to do. I mean, I would suggest it to almost anyone who, a very specific people that have specific skill sets that are good at probably just great at tournaments and maybe not be great at cash. Like for example, I don't know. I just thought of someone in my head, like Ari Engel. I don't know if he'd be, I don't want to say he'd be bad at cash, but he's just such a phenomenal like tournament player and phenomenal at reading spots and reading situations about who we can run over and who we can, because he's just a very aggressive player.
Yeah, and his Nick game is also so well suited for tournaments because he keeps expenses down like you wouldn't believe, or like I didn't believe. It was very impressive. We had him on the show. He's got the whole like Southwest thing where he like books 12 tickets and cancels 11 of them. He's amazing. That's
and he's like top tier in a couple airlines and flies first class for free, like he's amazing and all that stuff.
I interrupted
my mind. He's a great tournament player, and I at times wasn't sure like how good of a tournament player I am. It's hard to say. Like I'm confident in my game, but at the same time, when you have like a year and a half of tournaments where you just don't do anything, you start questioning yourself. But I mean, luckily after I went PCA, I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'm good again. You know what I mean? that's also like another bad thing about tournament poker is it just completely messes with your head. You have to like, you have to be really cool headed and be able to keep, what am I trying to say? Keep your finances well and not let bad beats and tournaments affect you, because if you lose any cash session, you go back the next day and you can almost, if you're a good player, winning player over the long term, you're still going to win 60-55% of sessions or whatever. Where tournaments, you could be a great player and just not cash for 30. I mean, theoretically, I believe at one time, which was an amazing stat. So pre maybe 2012, they kept WSOP records of entrance online. It was like WSOPDB.com or something. And the person with the most non-cashes in a row was literally, if I had to guess, someone who was the least likeliest, he might be it. Do you guys know who this is?
It's George Lind, right?
No, it was no. Well, it might have been him, but at one time it was Mike Watson. So
wait, really?
Oh wow. Yeah, and he is the person you would think least likely to,
because he's a very good player and he's on the tighter side. Like those two things, like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think he won over 30 or 40 or something World Series instead of cash. Wow. So it's just amazing the tournament variance over the long. I mean, over the short run and the long run, because you're never going to play enough tournaments over the long run, especially live tournaments.
It's so easy to have a bad year live.
But it can affect you, especially because it's a whole year. Where online it might be a month, and then you get back to it the next month. But when you play for a year and you don't win anything or don't even like come close to winning anything like I did last year, it can really affect you. And luckily like, yeah, I just won the first tournament in 2017. I was like, all right, well, back to being good again. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, I play like 5 live tournaments a year, so I could easily have a decade without cashing, right? I mean, yeah, I could go a decade without cashing. I mean, yeah, that's nuts. I mean, did you ever get people who come up to you and say, like, oh, hey, I'm an accountant. I play tournaments sometimes. Like, help me, Christian. I haven't cashed in 3 years. Like, you know, what do you do? Like, you're probably not great, but also it's pretty easy to not cash for 3 years if you play 5 tournaments a year, you know. That's
for sure. I mean, it's especially with that little, if you have a job and not really playing cash much, it can definitely just jade you. Though at the same time, tournaments are so fun, especially for recreational players, that, you know, they're always going to get good numbers, they're always going to be good fields. Yeah. You know, I think there's a chance in the future maybe live cash might not be amazing,
yeah,
in 10 years, but I think live tournaments for my lifetime will always be good.
I think there's a problem with live cash where, like, I mean, if you take the Foxwoods 2-5, it's still a very beatable game, but like if some just random, like, complete amateur wanders down from the pit, like, that person's gonna get chewed up pretty quick most of the time and probably is not gonna have a great experience. And not because it's all the best players in the world, but there will probably be like 5 or 6 guys at the table who know what they're doing and have played enough guys like that they're gonna chew him up fast, and he won't last 2 sessions the way he might have 10 years ago. So I agree. I think that live cash is might get a bit tougher, you know, tougher and tougher.
Yeah, and if you play you can play $300 live tournaments where you start with 1,000 big blinds.
Yeah.
And play for 8 hours and not cash, but you had a good experience and you spent $300. Where if you're, you know, playing live cash in the time span, playing, you know, 2-5, you easily lose 2,000. So I mean, it's for sure like what a lot of amateurs are going to play in the future, I think.
Yeah. Have you done something? We talked about, you know, Ari doing such a good job of kind of like managing his life pro expenses. Is that something that's on your mind a lot when you're traveling, or like how much do you factor travel costs into when you're planning like which events you're going to go to and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm probably somewhere in the middle of professional poker players in terms of that stuff. I'm not great with it, but I'm also conscious of expenses. But, you know, and I have certain, you know, good credit cards and all types of the award points with all the airlines. But at the same time, I'm not the best with keeping expenses super low, for sure. So somewhere in the middle, I'd say.
When you're, so I mean, I know, when was it when Maryland Live opened? Was that 2013?
The poker room?
I feel, yeah.
Because I feel like the casino was maybe 2012. That sounds, yeah, right.
The casinos were open for a while before they added poker.
Yeah, that sounds right. 2013 sounds right.
I mean, that must have been a huge boon for you.
Yeah, because, you know, my whole life I've lived in Maryland and we never had at all, you know, gambling or playing poker. Live casinos. So to play there, it was awesome. It was quite the treat to be able to, you know, drive there and drive home, for sure.
Where were you playing before that? Like, to play live cash, what did you...
I would go to Borgata, 3 hours, you know, 3 hour drive, play for the weekend, come back on Sunday or Monday. And I was playing probably even more tournaments back then because of not being able to play live cash in my backyard, for sure. Mm-hmm. I've gone on, you know, since then, I've gone on many spurts in Maryland Live where I'll play, you know, 4 days a week for a month. And then I won't play for a month because I'll be traveling. And then when I'm home, I know my next poker trip's a week away. And I'm just like, I don't even feel like playing. So it's hard. It's hard for me to find the balance, because I always want to play cash. But when I know my next trip, like for today, for example, I got home last night and I'm leaving in a week for Montreal. It's like, do I want to spend, and then I go to Montreal for a week and I'm home for 5 days and I go to California. Do I actually want to spend this time playing poker? It's a hard balance, for sure.
Yeah. What would you be doing if you don't play poker?
You know, hanging out with friends, playing daily fantasy sports, going to some Maryland basketball games, like I'm going on Saturday. So it should be fun.
It seems like you're sort of into food from your Twitter feed.
I am. I love food. I love finding great restaurants. I'm always looking. Whenever I go to a new city, like the first thing I do is look up like good restaurants, you know, nearby. And I love cooking food too. So when I'm home for a while, I definitely get in a groove of going to the grocery store and cooking things for sure.
What kind of stuff do you cook?
I cook everything. I mean, let's see. Some of my favorite things to cook. I like to do a lot of simple things. Just like I'll cook salmon with some protein, with some vegetables. I love making risotto, which, you know, it's long. It takes a while, but over time it's pretty easy to do once you figure it out.
My view on risotto is that it's good, but barley is like 98% as good and, you know, 3% of the work. So why not just make a pot of barley? Why am I stupid?
Oh, I don't know. It doesn't sound as decadent as some creamy risotto with some Parmesan in there.
Hey, there's nothing keeping you from putting cream with barley. You know, it's got like the same texture. It's about, you know, but it's easy. Just throw a bunch of barley in it. Yeah. Okay.
I'll have to look up some recipes.
No, I'm just lazy when it comes to cooking.
I can be at times, but sure. I love a good risotto. I'm a sucker for it.
Yeah. No, it's great. Creamy and wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'll take a moment to be even more selfish than usual on the podcast. Any Maryland restaurant recommendations that might not be on my radar? Actually, there's very little on my radar, so just Maryland restaurant recommendations.
My favorite Maryland restaurant, I would say, or Baltimore at least, would be Woodbury Kitchen. Which, have you been there?
Okay, I have actually been there. Yeah.
Yeah, I love Woodbury. I went there last week, actually. Everything's just so fresh. So it's all of it's like incredibly local. It's, you know, Woodbury's on like, you know, the best restaurants of Maryland and some even the best restaurants in the U.S. every year. So it's not like a major upset that you haven't heard of, that restaurant. And then locally, there's a restaurant in Annapolis called Vin 909, just sort of like a wine bar, but they do pizza really well, and they do a bunch of small dishes. This is also like, it's probably considered the best restaurant in Annapolis, so not exactly that secret though.
How did the maybe I don't even know your title with Maryland Live. I mean, I think of you as being like sponsored by them. Do you have a particular title there?
I am the ambassador, which I think is
ambassador. Okay.
I think it's sort of an absurd word, to be honest, but it makes it seem so like, but I think this is like, it's some, everyone in poker is an ambassador if they work with casino now. That's like the title. It just kind of caught on a couple of years ago, right? Everyone is, if they wear their patch, they're an ambassador. So yes, I am an ambassador.
If you win the main event, you have to be an ambassador. You become an ambassador for the game.
Of course. Like Joe McKeon. right. So basically, yeah, I represent them. I wear their patch. I do some stuff on social media. But yeah, play there a little bit, but I don't have to, you know, be there all the time. But how did that come about? I guess, so I've been with them for a year and a half. So maybe 2 years ago, we got to talking, sort of their poker room and their like marketing department sort of came to me and brought something up, and I was like, oh, sure, you want to pay me at a place that I'm already playing at? You know, I'd love to. But yeah, I mean, they've been amazing to me, and Mike Smith, the poker room manager there, is amazing at his job and a great guy, and worked out well for me for sure.
And I don't mean to imply, you know, anything about Maryland Live when I ask this, because I've had, you know, nothing but positive experiences there, except for maybe like very shortly after they opened. But I mean, what kind of stuff do you think about when you accept an endorsement deal like that? I mean, do you consider kind of like, is this a place that I want to put my name behind? Or like, I guess it's kind of like what goes through your head when you're offered an opportunity like that?
Yeah, I think that's the first thing. I mean, for me, it was easy because I enjoyed playing there, and it was 30 minutes from my house. So for me, it was a pretty easy decision. Obviously, that's, you know, if someone wanted me to represent them who I didn't, you know, my beliefs didn't align with, or I'd be embarrassed to represent them. I think that, and then I would say no. I mean, I think that's just like the biggest thing by far, for sure.
Or you'd say how much anyway, and yeah, it'd have to be a pretty big number.
I'm not a price, you know, I mean, if... I'm just kidding, but not really. But yeah,
no, it depends on. I mean, at least for me, it was sort of like there's plenty of stuff I wouldn't represent, no matter how much money. But if it was just like, you know, I I don't know. I can imagine situations where like the money would matter, but there are things that I would like, I don't love everything about what you do, but for $1 million, sure.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you can always justify this stuff. I'm going to give halfway to charity. So, I mean, how can you, you're a net positive.
Right. Promote
someone you don't associate with. But luckily that wasn't for me.
Are you involved at all with like setting tournament schedules or structures or anything like that with them?
A little bit, but not really. I think Jason, the tournament director, does a great job, and Mike. They've been doing so long and so well that I don't always want to try to interject myself because they know what they're doing better than me, actually. So not really. I don't help that much, but occasionally I'll bring up something, whether it's a tournament or whether it's just something that someone mentioned to me inside the casino. Hey, there'd be a good place to put a TV right here. And then I'll pass it along or something like that. But I'm not too involved in terms of behind the scenes stuff.
Do you have thoughts on like what makes a good tournament series? Like kind of what a casino should have, how long it should be, what kind of buy-ins they should have, that kind of thing?
You know, I think that's a really hard question to answer because I think a lot of it depends on the venue and the local players. For example, Atlantic City and Borgata specifically, they have such like a monopoly that they know that thousands of people are going to come. So it doesn't even matter what they put against the schedule. Not that TAB doesn't do a great job and they don't have a good schedule. But they want to put up small buy-in tournaments and massive guarantees, and it just brings in loads of people, which is just great for the kids, you know, great numbers, great for the prize pools. But there are other places where you can't really get away with that. Maryland Live, for example, can't have a tournament series with, you know, 1,000 person entrance. They don't have space for it. They don't have like a convention center. So I think a lot of it depends on the local players. There's certain areas that have just for some reason over time they've established as fantastic tournament areas, and some that are more like a cash game areas and casinos. So I think it's hard to answer about specifically what a tournament series should hold.
Now, in recent years, we've seen some tournament formats that didn't used to exist get more popular. So one of them is Colossus-style tournaments, where there are a lot of days you can enter. Sometimes you can re-enter in any of those days, and the idea is just to generate lots and lots of entries. And then you see like accumulator tournaments, and there are different sort of sub-flavors of those. Do you think that those are generally good for poker, or some of them are good and some of them are bad? I mean, do you have any worries about those?
I think they're good for the most part. I think when you have these massive field, I think it really, the recreational players love the small buy-in, zillion flights, zillion entrants, zillion for first place. I mean, there's a lot of positive, especially for the recreational players. You know, you can have tournaments where you run in a day one on every day of the week, and then day two is on Saturday, so you don't really have to miss work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think most of these tournaments have been geared towards recreational players, and I think that's great, probably, because it's nothing stopping the pros from playing them, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think people being obsessed with starting with a lot of chips is kind of dumb, but that's just sort of how it's happened. Because it doesn't always make it a better structure if you start with more chips. Mm-hmm. Some people fail to realize that, I think. And the rate can be high, especially when it's re-entries. And all of a sudden, you know, you're playing a $500, that's $70 in rake, $8 in rake, and then you're playing it 10 times. you're paying a lot more rake than if you just played a $5,000 tournament and play that.
I guess it seems to me that in some ways that kind of tournament is a hybrid tournament and cash game. And if you're right that live cash might not be sustainable, that might be sort of a more sustainable version of live cash. Is that a crazy way to think about it?
I never really thought of that, actually. It's interesting. I'll have to think about that more. I'm not sure how to... Maybe.
Because, I mean, you know, if you lose once, you don't have to go home. The price point is about right. It's not so hard to guarantee yourself a chance to play on the next day. But then there comes a point where, you know, it's a tournament and you're gambling for a lot of money. I don't know. Maybe it's not the right way to think about it. But
the only thing I would disagree with, well, not disagree with, just say that, is if, like, the Borgata 500 just said 5,000 entrants, the variance in that is just so insane that, like, you're just going to end up losing or winning very small, like such a high percentage of the time, that it's
yeah
that would kind of be hard to like quantify as like close to cash game.
Yeah, but I think like if you think about what tournaments used to be like, I mean, I remember when late registration was considered sort of a wild innovation, you know, the whole idea of a tournament is like you fly somewhere. Sometimes there aren't even a whole lot of prelims, but you know, you get one chance, and then if you lose, you're gone, and you have to either, you know, play cash or, you know, go to a museum or something, heaven forbid, in the rest of your time there. And this is just like a very different model of tournaments that we have now, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's great for the casinos, too. They just keep getting rigged.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
But I think it also is, though there's some problems with these massive re-entries. It's probably a net positive for the players, too.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, a huge positive for the casinos. So it's here to stay for sure. It's definitely going to be the future of small blind tournaments. I think, you know, will be like massive re-entries for sure.
Yeah. When online poker was sort of near its final days, at least as we used to know it, we saw a lot of tournament structures that in hindsight look like desperate cash grabs before things went south. Do you ever worry that there's going to be like a tragedy of the commons where people are locally incentivized to run sort of terrible tournament structures and there's a race to the bottom and it winds up with just an unsustainable economy?
It's a cynical way of thinking. I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not either. I sort of think no, but I respect people who say yes.
It's hard to say, but yeah. I think no.
Okay. Not. Hey, great. Boom. Christian Harder, optimist about the future of live tournaments. You can take that to the bank.
Hopefully.
What do you look for when you're setting your schedule? I mean, are you mostly going to the same places year after year, or you know, or do you sometimes change it up?
For the most part, I go to similar places. I'm looking for something not too far away, outside of my trips to Vegas and like California. Really, I'm always on like a flight that's like 3 hours or less. Easy to get into, good, decent buy-in. I don't really want to travel unless it's a $3,500 or more guarantee, stuff like that. Usually things that are attached to big tours, just because I know certain things are going to be, you know, okay. If it's a WPT or if it's whatever.
How much do you think about what the fields are going to look like? Or you know, how much do you try to game that?
A little bit. I mean, you're talking about field size or field strength?
Mostly field strength. I mean, so it kind of seems like there should be some sort of equilibrium where, like, it doesn't really make sense for even if, say, you know, Maryland Live runs a fantastic tournament series. I mean, there's some point where it doesn't make sense for every pro on the East Coast to go there, because then, like, the games at Borgata are going to be, like, absurdly soft if every Borgata pro is at Maryland Live. So, I mean, for some people, and maybe this is more for, like, lower-tier people, it kind of makes sense for them to sort of, like, game and the equilibrium involves, like, not everyone going to the same place, I guess.
It's true. I think about it sometimes, but I think for the most part, most tournaments in the U.S., the 5K and 3Ks, 3,500s are pretty great. This last December, I wasn't going to go to Five Diamond because, well, you know, 2 years ago, it wasn't very good. And it's a 10K reentry. It's a big buy-in. And it's just going to be mostly good players. And then the last second, I booked a flight arriving on day two because you can buy into freaking 3 days, Poggio. And it turned out to be a great tournament. So I was pretty happy that I ended up running to that. But yeah, I almost didn't go to that because of that. But, as I said, I'm still addicted to these big buy-in, big prize pool tournaments, so I still flew out.
I'm really sorry. I have to ask a self-indulgent question. We had TJ Jerkowitz on the show, and yeah. He said that he went up to you and asked how he'd get better at tournaments, and you said something like, "This guy Nate Mavis wrote a book. You should get it." Is that true? And if so, like, oh my God, what? Why do you? Like, did that really happen?
I don't know if it happened exactly like that, because I haven't read your book, but I know you're extremely, extremely bright. That's bright funny. Pokemon. And I think a lot of just literature is good, because I knew TJ he's a reader. He likes to read. So I knew something about a book would help him.
Yeah. All right. So that's a story that I can actually believe and am still very flattered by. So awesome.
It's partly true.
All right. I'll take it. Thanks.
There's rumors that Todd Brunson has read Nate's book, so you don't have you would be in good company.
Yeah.
Todd Brunson claims that I am the only author of a poker book he's ever read. I don't know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, he says a lot of things with his tongue in his cheek, so I would not bet my life on that being true. especially on Twitter. He's a big fan of what Rush Limbaugh would call a media tweak, so I don't know. Like, maybe he's just messing with me or something. But it could be true. It could be true. Like, he asked me to have a copy of the book printed out and sent to him, and I did it, and he thanked me for it. So, I don't know.
That right there probably tells you it's true.
Yeah.
He wouldn't tell you that hard, would he?
I don't know.
That would be pretty sick.
That's a massive troll if he did that part.
Yeah.
It's one thing to tweet something, but to, like...
Yeah, I don't know. But then, boom, next year he ran deep in the main event. So there you have it. So that's...
Boom.
Well, do you have any specific, like, goals in poker? I mean, do you have an idea of, like, it's really important to me to, you know, win a bracelet or... I don't know, do you have, like, particular things you're trying to accomplish, or are you just making a living?
Yeah, not really. I definitely, you know, I just accomplished this. Just winning a major tournament, I would say, was probably my, like, really my only goal in terms of tournament poker. So to finally win a major tournament, it felt awesome. The support I got was crazy. So that was definitely awesome to finally do that.
So but you're not done. I mean, it doesn't sound like you're about to quit now that you've accomplished your goal.
I'll still be playing. It's not going to really affect. I probably won't even play more buy-ins than I was going to. Maybe a little bit, obviously, but not much. But yeah, I don't have any out there goals. I don't come from the Daniel Negreanu dream, declare, deliver.
What, you don't intend to have a certain number of chips at the end of the day?
I love Daniel, but I think that stuff, especially the chip stack at the end of the day, is kind of ridiculous. But yeah, that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah. Anything we left off? Anything interesting about Christian Harder that we didn't know enough to ask?
I don't know. I think you did most of it. Got my poker story. You know.
Let's get a Super Bowl prediction.
Falcons 35-33.
Wow, all right, that's a good prediction. We're collecting predictions for the Super Bowl that will air after the Super Bowl. So, you know, it's like a usual Super Bowl prediction, but less interesting. So that's.
You'll know the results. You can call them stupid or not.
People will know. People will be able to judge you immediately when they hear this.
I don't know. I sort of just feel like it's the Falcons' year for whatever reason, even though the Patriots are such a juggernaut. Yeah. And I'm actually pretty sure I am recorded on Poker Central during the PCA saying the Patriots would win. So I'm going to cancel that and officially have the Falcons as the winner.
Boom, you heard it here. Thinking Poker Podcast, the source for Christian Harder's official Super Bowl prediction.
All right,
thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, guys. This was fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Have a good one.
Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.